Overcoming Nervousness, an introduction by Michael Lipson.
In this lecture, Rudolf Steiner introduces a principle that sets his approach apart from many spiritual and psychological techniques. This principle is psychic hierarchy, that each level of a human's being should inform, from above, the level just beneath it. All psychic distress, Steiner implies, derives from a breakdown in such hierarchy. The fundamental insight here, distinctive of anthroposophy, is that lower, even diseased aspects of the mind are in fact transformations and degenerations of something august. Emerson wrote, "Our being is descending into us from we know not whence," with descending as the operative term. What we know only too well, how anxious and afraid we are, how out of sorts, can be recognized as the fallen form of a high spiritual essence. The original German title of the essay encapsulates Steiner's concept of hierarchy in a simple binary formula, Nervosität und Ichheit, or nervousness and I-hood. These two are the poles of our mental life. Whenever I am active, nervousness cannot appear, for nervousness is made up precisely of the unused potential of the self. As a recently published record of Angelic Conversation puts it, nervousness is being without goal. The purpose of Steiner's injunctions is to redirect us so that our psyche's being regains its goal and its activity casts out nervousness. This process may be none other than what John meant by saying, "Perfect love casteth out all fear." If we examine how broadly Steiner uses the term nervousness and reflect that the word is a close sibling of neurosis, we begin to realize Steiner's therapeutic scope and the enormous implication of the techniques and topics addressed here. What Freud attempted to do in psychoanalysis, Steiner achieved in anthroposophy from quite the opposite direction. Unlike Freud, who would conquer neurosis, a term that smells of formaldehyde in the hospital, by transforming the lower animal urges into higher egoic reflectivity, Steiner sought to expel nervousness, the lived experience of a misled life, by reorienting the soul to its divine origin. In the years since Steiner and Freud died, nervousness has surely only increased its hold on Western people. So, too, have the psychotherapeutic techniques supposed to alleviate it. While many of these may be of dubious value or even contribute to the problem, others may be effective. Certainly, later authors have unknowingly recommended psychotherapeutic practices already suggested by Steiner. For example, the technique Steiner discusses of allowing inner voices to speak the pros and cons of a decision, and then oneself choosing among these voices, closely resembles the Gestalt two-chair technique and its derivatives, such as the voice dialogue method of Harold Stone. In Stone's work, the client is directed to speak alternately out of many inner personas, thereby strengthening the central I in its supervisory role. In this brief lecture, Steiner also finds time to foresee a number of visualization and cognitive behavioral techniques invented in recent decades. Above and beyond these many hints, however, two further anticipations deserve special mention. Steiner's observations of the harmful effects of student cramming seems almost to have come from the same writer as Simone Weil's much later Reflections on the Right Use of School Studies with a View to the Love of God. In that essay, Weil emphasizes the importance of the attention, which is exercised all the more intensely when applied to something we do not find intrinsically interesting. She equates attention, as does Steiner in this lecture, with the essence of the human spirit. Again, Steiner's lesson that we teach our children more by example than by precept has the ring of difficult truth. For who can change his or her behavior with the same ease as mouthing maxims? It is said that Mahatma Gandhi was approached by a mother with her young son. The mother begged Gandhi, "Gandhiji, please, my son eats too much sugar. It is not healthy. Tell him to stop." Gandhi replied, "Come back in 3 days." When in 3 days mother and son returned, Gandhi said to the boy, "Do not eat sugar, it is not good for you," and he bade them farewell. The boy's mother was grateful, but asked Gandhi why he had not given the simple advice 3 days before. "3 days ago," replied the saint, "I had not given up sugar myself." Perhaps the most remarkable aspect of this story is that it took Gandhi only 3 days to know that he had given up sugar. Anyone familiar with Steiner's writings and lectures will recognize in this lecture on nervousness a pervasive characteristic of his work. Steiner recommends many exercises. In fact, he recommends so many exercises that the reader is not merely unlikely to attempt them all, but unlikely to attempt a single one. Readers may feel swamped by such a deluge of recommendations, suggestions, techniques, and projects to be undertaken. This very overabundance, however, is the token of something quite wonderful and altogether unusual in traditional psychology, in a New Age spiritual psychology. For Steiner, the psyche is alive. Its descriptions cannot be pieced together from a finite number of component parts. Its evolution cannot be accomplished or even delineated by a finite number of precepts. Its depths, as well as its heights, bristle with infinities. Therefore, whoever speaks from the psyche's own sources cannot offer limited viewpoints. We may taste, in Steiner's overabundance, something of the living waters Christ offered to the Samaritan woman. And we may ask in wonder, as she did, "Sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence, then, hast thou that living water?" Michael Lipson.
Overcoming Nervousness, a lecture by Rudolf Steiner, given January 11, 1912. The suggestions to be given today connect with much that we already know, but they can still be useful for one or another of us and can even lead us into more exact contemplation of the essence of the human being and of its connection with the world. The anthroposophist can very often hear all kinds of things from non-anthroposophists, apart from the many rebuttals and objections against spiritual science lately mentioned in the public lectures. For example, both learned and unlearned people object over and over again to our speaking in spiritual science about the division of the whole human being into those four members that we always bring up: physical body, ether or life body, astral body, and the I. And then doubters can object, so to speak, "Well, maybe that's how it is for someone who has developed certain hidden forces of the soul. Maybe such a person can see this composition of the human being. But someone who doesn't see such things can have no reason to turn toward such a viewpoint." However, we must emphasize that if one is attentive to human life, this life, in a certain sense, can give corroborations of what spirit knowledge has to say. Further, if one applies what one can learn from spirit knowledge to one's life, then such an application proves extraordinarily useful. And one soon finds that this usefulness can gradually give us a kind of conviction, even if we do not want to enter into what clairvoyant perception offers. It is only too well known that in our time, people complain often of what we can encompass with the much feared word nervousness. And we would not be surprised in the least if someone feels driven to say, "In our time, there is really no one left who is not nervous about something." How understandable this statement is in a certain way. Quite apart from the social relationships and conditions to which we can ascribe this or that cause for this nervousness, the nervous conditions, as we have characterized them, are there. They express themselves in life in the most varied ways. They express themselves, as we could perhaps say, in the lightest way, in the least uncomfortable way, when a person becomes what we could call a will-o'-the-wisp of the soul. This is the name I would give to a person who is incapable of holding on to a thought properly and pursuing its consequence in a real way. Such people hop from one thought to another. If you want to hold them in one place, they have already long ago gone somewhere else. A hastiness of the soul life, this is often the lightest form of nervousness. Another kind of nervousness is that of people who don't know what to do with themselves. When things require a decision from them, they cannot decide, and never really know for sure what they should do in this or that situation. And then, these conditions can lead on to other, already more serious cases, such that this nervousness lives itself out gradually more and more in actual forms of disease, for which, perhaps, one can cite no organic cause. These forms of disease sometimes mimic organic diseases in a deceptive way, so that one could believe that a person has, perhaps, a serious stomach ailment, but really suffers only from what one can sum up, even if trivially and without much meaning, under the word nervousness. And countless other conditions. Who among us is not familiar with them? Who does not suffer from them, either because we have them ourselves or because others in our environment have them? One need not go so far as to speak about the great events of the outer life as a political alcoholism, but people have spoken in recent days about that kind of nervous activity in public life as a kind of conduct that otherwise only expresses itself in an individual who has been infected somewhat by alcoholism. The word is appropriate for the way political affairs have been conducted in Europe over the last months. One also sees in outward life something about which one could say, here too, one notices not only that nervousness is present, but that people sense it in a certain connection as something quite unpleasant. Everywhere, then, something like nervousness is present. All this will, in the near future, grow worse and worse for people. If people remain as they are, then a good outlook for the future cannot by any means be offered, for there are harmful influences that affect our current life in a quite extraordinary way, and that carry over from one person to another like an epidemic. Therefore, people become a bit diseased in this direction. Not only the ones who have the illness, but also others, who are perhaps only weak but otherwise healthy, get it by a kind of infection. It is enormously harmful for our time that a great number of the people who arrive in prominent public positions study in the way that people study at present. There are actually whole branches of study in which one lives, let us say, the whole year at the university doing things other than thinking through and studying through what the professors are saying. One goes into lectures now and then, but what one really wants to learn is acquired in a few weeks. That is to say, people cram. The bad part is the cramming. And since, in a certain regard, this cramming goes as far as to the lower grades, the ills that come from it are by no means inconsiderable. The essential part of this cramming is that there is no real connection of the soul interest, of the innermost kernel of the being, with what one crams. In the schools, the reigning opinion among the students is even, "Oh, if only I could now forget what I have just learned." So that vehement wanting to possess what one learns is not present. A slight chain of interest links the human soul kernel with what people take in. Now, people can be made fit in this way in a certain regard to take a hand in public life, because they crammed or learned the thing they wanted to learn, but since they are not inwardly connected with it, they are far away in the soul from what they are doing in their head. And for the whole human being, there is hardly anything worse than being far away in the soul, with one's heart, from what the head must perform. This not only goes against the nature of a finer, more sensitive person, but also influences the strength and energy of the human etheric body to the highest degree, precisely of the etheric body. The ether, or life body, becomes ever weaker from such activity because of the slight connection that exists between the human soul kernel and what the person is doing. The more people have to do with what does not interest them, the weaker they make their ether body. Anthroposophy, if acquired in a healthy way, should do more than teach people that a human being consists of physical body, ether body, and so forth. Anthroposophy should also have the healthy effect of developing strongly these individual members within the human being. Now, if a person makes a very simple experiment, but repeats this experiment eagerly, then a triviality can actually work wonders. Forgive me if today I speak just of individual observations, of trivialities, but these can become very significant for the life of the human being. For intimately connected with what I have just characterized is the light forgetfulness that people sometimes show. Light forgetfulness is something unpleasant in life. Anthroposophy can, however, show us that this forgetfulness is damaging to health in the most eminent sense. And strange as it may sound, It is true that many outbreaks of human nature that border on being very deceased would be avoided if people were less forgetful. Now you can say they are forgetful. Indeed, who can say, as we realize, if we have an overview of life, that they are completely free of forgetfulness? Take a really trivial case. A person discovers he is forgetful in that he never knows where he has put the things he uses. This is something that happens in life, isn't it? One person cannot find the cufflinks that he put down the evening before. Another can never find her pencil, and so on. It seems strange and banal to talk about these things, but they do happen in life. And precisely from observation of what we can learn in anthroposophy, there is a good exercise for gradually improving this condition of forgetfulness. Here is the very simple technique. Now, let us assume a lady puts down, say, her brooch, or a man puts down his cufflinks somewhere in the evening. And when they cannot find these objects the next morning, they realize their tendency to forgetfulness. Now, you could say, yes, certainly, and one can accustom oneself to always putting them down in the same place. That won't be possible for all objects. However, we do not want to speak at the moment of this particular means of curing oneself, but rather of the much more effective means. Namely, assume that a person who notices a tendency to forgetfulness immediately says inwardly, I now want to place the objects in very different spots, but I want never to place an object in a specific spot without also developing the thought, when I put it down, I have placed this object in this spot. Then one tries to imprint in oneself an image of the surroundings. Let us assume we place a safety pin at the edge of a table at the corner. We lay it down with the thought, I am laying down this pin on this edge, and I imprint the right angle around it as a picture, such that the pin is surrounded on two sides by edges, and so on, and I go calmly away from the place. And I will see that even if it doesn't work out right in every case, if I make this practice a rule, then my forgetfulness will fall away from me more and more. It depends on a very specific thought being formulated, namely the thought, I am laying the pin down there. I have brought my I into connection with what I am carrying out. And besides that, I have added something in the way of a picture. Pictoriality in thinking, what I myself am doing. And besides this pictorial mental imaging, I bring the fact into connection with the kernel of my essence. This bringing together with the soul spiritual kernel of essence as addressed with the little word I, along with pictoriality, can sharpen our memory quite fundamentally. In this way, we have something useful for life, since we become less forgetful. Perhaps we would not make so much of it if that were all that could be achieved, but much more can be achieved in this way. Let us assume that it became a custom among people to evoke such thoughts when they lay down certain objects. Then this custom alone would evoke a strengthening of the human ether body. The human ether body is, in fact, more and more consolidated by doing this kind of thing. It becomes ever stronger and stronger. We have learned from anthroposophy that the ether, or life body, must be for us, in a certain sense, the bearer of the memory. If we do something that strengthens the powers of memory, then we can understand right away that such a strengthening of the powers of memory aids our ether body. As anthroposophists, we need not be so very surprised about it. But suppose you suggest to someone who not only is forgetful, but also shows certain conditions of nervousness, what has been described here. If the restless or nervous person does this, accompanies the placement of objects with such thoughts, then you will see that he or she not only becomes less forgetful, but also gradually, through the strengthening of the ether body, puts aside certain so-called nervous conditions. Then a proof will have been provided, through life, that what we say about the ether body is right. For if we behave in the corresponding way toward the ether body, it definitely shows that it assumes these forces. So what we say about it is correct. Life proves, in such a case, that this is extraordinarily important. Another matter, which once again can seem to be a triviality, but which is extraordinarily important. You know that what we call the physical body and the ether body border immediately on one another in the human being. The ether body is immediately contained within the physical. Now, today, you can make an observation that is not so very rare at all, an observation whose validity is not known to those people about whom we make the observation. When we make this observation and bear within us a healthy, compassionate soul, then we will have precisely compassion for these people we are observing. Have you seen, for example, people writing at the post office counter who make very peculiar movements before they begin to write a letter? Before they begin to write a B, for instance? First they make some movement in the air and then begin. Or it need not even go so far, for this is already the indication of a serious condition. If people are forced through their jobs to do such things, it may merely go so far that people, watch them sometime, have to give themselves a little jolt, so to speak, with each stroke, and in fact, they write jaggedly, not going up and down evenly, but jaggedly. You can see it in the handwriting in this way. From spiritual scientific knowledge, we can understand such a condition in the following way. For a completely healthy human being, healthy in regard to the physical body and ether body, the ether body, which is directed by the astral body, must always be able to take absolute hold of the physical body, and the physical body must everywhere in all its movements be able to become a servant of the ether body. If the physical body moves on its own, beyond what the soul can really want, that is, what the astral body can really want, then it is an unhealthy condition, a preponderance of the physical body over the etheric body. And in everyone who has the conditions just described, we once again have to do with a weakness of the etheric body, which consists in its no longer being able fully to control the physical body. This relationship of the etheric body to the physical body even lies occultly at the base of all conditions of cramping, which are fundamentally connected in that the etheric body exercises a lesser command over the physical body than it should exercise, so that the physical dominates and carries out all kinds of movements on its own. Meanwhile, the human being is healthy in relation to the fullness of its being only if everything that it does is subordinate to the will of the astral body. Now, here again there is a possibility, if this condition has not gained too much the upper hand, of helping people. Only one must reckon with the occult facts. One has to reckon with the need for the etheric body, as such, to be strengthened. One must, to a certain extent, believe in the existence and effective capacity of the ether body. Suppose an unfortunate man has so ruined himself that he continually makes restless motions with his fingers before he begins to write this or that letter. Now, it will be good in all circumstances to advise the person, "All right, take a vacation and write less for a while and you will get better." But this advice is only halfway advice. One could do much more if one also gave the person another suggestion, the second half of the advice. And try, without making a lot of effort, a quarter or a half hour every day or enough, try to take on a different handwriting, to change your writing style, so that you are required not to write mechanically, as you have up until now, but to pay attention. Whereas you used to write the F in that way, now write it steeper and in a quite different form, so that you must pay attention. Accustom yourself to painting the letters. If spiritual knowledge were more widespread, then when such a person came back from vacation and had acquired a new handwriting style, his superiors would not say, "What kind of guy are you? You write completely differently." People would realize that this is a fundamental curative technique. For we are forced, when we change our writing in this way, to be attentive to what we are doing. And to be attentive to what we are doing always means to bring the innermost kernel of our being into intimate connection with the matter at hand. And everything, in turn, that brings the innermost kernel of our being into connection with what we do strengthens our ether body. In this way, we become healthy human beings. It would be good to work on a certain strengthening of the ether body systematically in upbringing and in school, so that it occurs even in youth. Here, what Anthroposophy suggests today will not be carried out for a long time, because the authorities in question will count Anthroposophy as something strange for a long time. But it doesn't matter. Let us assume that in teaching children to write, we first teach them a certain style of writing. And then, after a few years, we simply change the writing style without any other reason than to do so. Then, the change in handwriting and the strengthening of the attention that would have to come about during the change would have an enormously strengthening influence on the developing ether body, and many of the nervous conditions people have would not come up. So you see that one can do something in life that strengthens the ether body, and this is of extraordinary importance, for it is precisely the weakness of the ether body that leads to the numerous really unhealthy situations in the present time. It can even be said, and truly it is not saying too much, that certain forms of disease, which may very well be based in things about which nothing can be done, would run a very different course if the ether body were stronger than they run in the case of a weakened ether body, which is the standard feature of contemporary humanity. With this, we have pointed to something that can be referred to as working on the ether body. We apply certain things to the ether body. One cannot apply anything at all to something that isn't there, something that can be denied. By showing that it is useful to do certain things with the etheric body, and by being able to prove that these things have an effect, one is showing that something like the etheric body does exist. Everywhere, life offers appropriate proofs of what Anthroposophy has to give us. Our etheric body can also grow fundamentally stronger if we do something else to improve our memory. Perhaps, in another connection, this has already been mentioned here. But for all forms of disease in which nervousness plays a part, one should certainly take advice drawn from this area as well. That is, one can do an enormous amount to strengthen the etheric body if one remembers the things one knows, not only in the normal order one knows them, but also remembering them backward. Let us say that in school someone has to learn a string of rulers or battles or other events. They are learned according to the year in which they occurred. It is extraordinarily good not only to have them learned and to learn them oneself in the normal order, but also to learn the matter in reverse order, running through everything for oneself from back to front. This is an extraordinarily important matter. For if we do something like this, in a more comprehensive way, we contribute once again to an enormous strengthening of our etheric body. To think through whole dramas backward to the beginning, or stories we have read, these are things that are important to the highest degree for the consolidation of the etheric body. Now you will be able to see that today people do not apply in life any of what we have just been discussing. In the contemporary restless racing of the day, we have very little chance to arrive at the inner peace that allows us to carry out such exercises. Normally, a working person is too tired by evening to think any of the thoughts that we have been discussing. But if spiritual science penetrates into people's hearts and souls, then they will realize that we could really do without an infinite amount of what goes on these days, and actually everyone can take the amount of time necessary for strengthening exercises of this kind. People would see very quickly, especially if they took pains with such things in the realm of education, that enormously favorable results are the consequences. Let us mention another triviality, which, to be sure, is not so very useful in later life, but if a person has not cultivated it in early youth, then it is good to practice it in later life. That is, to look again at certain things we accomplish, regardless of whether they leave a trace or not. This is relatively easy with regard to what we write. I'm even convinced that many people could disabuse themselves of ugly handwriting if they tried, letter by letter, to look at what they have written, really to let their eyes pass again over what they have just written. This is possible to do quite well, but there is still another exercise that is very useful. That is, try to look at how we walk, how we move our hands, our head, how we laugh, and so forth. In short, if we try to give ourselves a pictorial account of our gestures. Very few people, this is something you can realize if you observe life closely enough, know how they walk. Very few have an idea of how it looks to someone who notices this. But it is good to do some of that, to gain a mental picture of oneself. For, if we apply this sort of thing in life, we will doubtlessly correct much of what we do. As indicated, it must not be pursued too far, or it contributes too much toward human vanity. But apart from that, it can have an enormously favorable effect on the consolidation of the etheric body, and also on the control of the etheric body by the astral body. And when we observe our gestures, when we look at what we do, when we have a mental image of our deeds, the control of the etheric body by the astral body grows ever stronger and stronger. That is, we arrive at the point where we can even, if necessary, suppress something we do. As things stand, people are less and less able to suppress something habitual at will, or to do something differently. But one of the greatest achievements of the human being is the ability to do what one does differently at times. We are not trying to establish a handwriting school here. These days, people might want to learn to alter their handwriting only to use it dishonestly. But as long as one undertakes to be perfectly honorable about it, it is good for the consolidation of the etheric body to take on a different handwriting. And in general, it is good to acquire the ability to do things one has planned in a different way, not to be set on doing something only in one way. So, we do not need to be fanatical advocates of equal facility with both hands. But if we nevertheless attempt in a moderate way to do certain tasks with the left hand, we need not force it beyond what we really can do. Then, this favorably influences the control that our astral body should exercise over our etheric body. Strengthening the human being in the way offered by spiritual scientific insight is something that should be brought to our culture through the spread of spiritual science. And in fact, this is something of great import. It could be called the cultivation of the will. Earlier, we emphasized that nervousness expresses itself precisely in the confusion people often feel today about how to set about doing what they really wish to do, or actually should wish to do. They draw back from carrying out what they have undertaken. They don't bring it off, and so on. This can be formulated as a certain weakness of the will, and it is caused by the lack of control of the astral body by the eye. There is always insufficient control of the astral body by the eye when this kind of weakness of will appears. It is as if people simultaneously want something and don't want it, or at least don't manage to really carry out what they want. Many do not even manage to earnestly want what they want to want. Now, there is a simple means to strengthen the will for the outer life. The means is this: to suppress wishes that are doubtless there, not to act on them, if non-action on the wishes is not harmful and is possible. For if we examine ourselves in life, we find from morning to night countless things that we want, which it would be nice to have, but we also find many such wishes that we can forgo without harming someone else and without neglecting our own responsibilities. Wishes whose satisfaction would give a certain pleasure, but which could also remain unsatisfied. If, then, one proceeds systematically, one can find among one's many wishes those of which it can be said, "No, now I will not fulfill that wish." This is not to be done in the wrong way, but only with something that leads to no harm, whose fulfillment would bring nothing but comfort, happiness, pleasure. If one systematically suppresses wishes of this kind, then every suppression of a kind of wish means an increase in strength of will, in the strength of the I over the astral body. And if in later life we submit ourselves to such a procedure, then we will be able to make up in this regard for much that education currently neglects in many ways. Now, it is actually quite difficult to work effectively in this area, for one has to take into account that even if one as a teacher, let's say, is in the position of being able to satisfy some emerging wish of a child or some young person and refuses the wish, then not only a simple non-action may be set up, but also a kind of antipathy. But this can be harmful in a pedagogical sense, so that one could perhaps say, yes, it looks doubtful whether one should introduce into one's educational principles the non-fulfillment of wishes of the students. One stands here before a real dilemma. If a father wants to educate his child by saying as often as possible, "No, you can't have that," then he will more definitely evoke the child's distaste for himself than he will achieve the good that is aimed at through non-fulfillment of wishes. The question arises, what is to be done? And one could simply not introduce such things at all. But there is a very simple way to introduce it. One refuses the wishes, not to the young person, but to oneself, but in such a way that the young person is aware that one has foregone this or that. Now, in the first 7 years of life, but even later as an after effect, a strong imitative drive is in effect, and we shall see, if we forgo this or that in the presence of those we have to educate, that they imitate this. They see it as something worth striving for, and with this we will be doing something enormously significant. So we see that our thoughts need only be led and directed in the right way through what spiritual science can be for us. Then spiritual science will not be theory, it will become life wisdom, really something that supports us and carries us further in life. An important means of strengthening the control of our I over the astral body can be learned to a certain extent from the two public lectures that I held here. The special thing about these two lectures was that what could be said both for and against a thing was introduced. If you test how people position themselves in life in terms of their souls, you will see that generally when people have to act or think, they actually only say what can be said either for or against a thing. That is the norm. But there is nothing in life that cannot be handled in such a way that there is both a pro and a con, nothing at all. There is a pro and a con for everything, and it is good if we accustom ourselves always to take into account not only the one, but also the other, not only the pro or the con, but also the pro and the con. Even for things that we then actually do, it is good to present to oneself why we would do better under certain circumstances not to do it, or simply, if it is better to do it, to make clear to oneself that there are also reasons against doing it. Vanity generally contradicts the notion that one should bring up the counter-arguments against what one does, since people want only too much to be purely good. A person can seem to offer proof of being a good person by saying, "I only do what there are good reasons for." And it is uncomfortable to realize that there are also many objections for almost everything that one does in life. We are really, I say it because it is extraordinarily important for life, not at all as good as we think. But this generalization has little purpose. It only has purpose if in the individual things one does, despite carrying them out, since life does demand them, one also considers what could lead us to forego them. What this achieves can be presented to our soul in the following simple way. You will certainly have already encountered people who are weak-willed in the sense that they would rather not decide anything for themselves, but always prefer that the other person make the decision for them, so that they only have to carry out what they are supposed to do. They dump the responsibility, so to speak, and prefer to ask what they are supposed to do instead of finding the reasons for this or that action by themselves. Now, I do not introduce this case in order to present it as important in itself, but to achieve something else. Let us take a person of this kind who likes to ask others. Mind you, what I have said is something that can be easily objected to, as well as assented to. One can hardly utter anything in life that couldn't be refuted in some fashion. Let us take such a person confronting two people who give advice on the same issue. One says, yes. The other says, don't do it. Then we will experience in life that one advisor wins out over the other advisor. The one who has a stronger influence on that person's will wins out over the other. What kind of phenomenon is this really? As insignificant as it seems, it is a highly significant phenomenon. If I stand before two people, one of whom says yes, the other no, and I carry out the yes, then that will works on in me. That strength of will has made itself felt in such a way that it empowered me to my action. One person's strength of will won out in me over the other person. The strength of that human being was victorious in me. Now, assume that I am not standing before two other people, one of whom says yes, the other no, but that I stand there quite alone and bring out for myself the yes or no in my own heart, and bring up the reasons for each one. No one else comes to me, but I myself bring up the reasons for and against the matter. That develops a strong power, but now it is within myself. What earlier was exercised in me by the other person, I have now developed for myself as a strength within my soul. So if I pose a choice to myself inwardly, I allow a strength to conquer a weakness. And this is enormously important, because this again strengthens the control of the I over the astral body tremendously. Now we should not regard this as something unpleasant. To really honestly test the pros and cons in every individual case, wherever possible, and if we attempt to carry out what we have been describing, we will then see that a great deal has been achieved toward the strengthening of the will. But the issue also has a shadow side, namely that instead of a strengthening of the will, a weakening can emerge. This occurs if, after evaluating the pros and cons for oneself, one then does not act under the influence of one or the other power, but rather does nothing at all, out of a negligence, following neither the one way nor the other. It seems then that one has obeyed the no, but really one has simply been lazy. Consequently, it is a good idea not to proceed with the self-presentation of pros and cons when you are tired, nor in any way worn out, but only when you feel strong, so that you know I am not worn out, I can really follow through with the reason for presenting the pros and cons to myself. So care must be taken to allow these things to have an effect on the soul at the proper time. Among the things that strengthen the control of our I over our astral body, it is important to divert from our souls everything that in any way sets up a contradiction between us and our environment. Of course, it is not among the duties of an anthroposophist to forbid oneself justified criticism. If the criticism is appropriate, then naturally it would be a weakness to pretend that what is bad is good, for purely spiritual scientific reasons, so to speak. But we need not do anything of the kind. Still, we have to learn to distinguish between what we criticize for its own sake and what we find uncomfortable, irritating, because of its influence on our own personality. And the more we can accustom ourselves to make the judgment of our fellow humans independently of the way they stand in relation to ourselves, the better it is for the strengthening of our I in its control over the astral body. It is even good to impose on ourselves a certain renunciation, but not so as to be able to boast to ourselves that we are good people if we don't criticize our neighbors. Rather, to make ourselves strong, we should strive not to be distressed by things that we might find distressing only because they are unpleasant to ourselves. And precisely in the area of judging our neighbors, The task would be to apply negative judgments, preferably where one does not come into the picture oneself in any way. We will soon see that, although this looks easy as a theoretical proposition, it is extraordinarily difficult to practice in real life. It is good when, for example, you have been lied to by a person, to hold back your antipathy, the antipathy that comes from his or her having lied to you. It is not a question of going to others and further purveying the story that has been told, but simply of holding back the feeling of antipathy from that person having lied to you. We can certainly use what we notice about people from one day to the next, the way their actions fit together, toward a judgment about them. If people talk one way at one time and another way at another time, then we need only compare what they do, and we have a very different basis for judging them than if we emphasize their behavior to ourselves. And this is important, that we allow things as such to speak for themselves, or that we understand people as such from their own actions, not judging from individual behaviors, but from how their actions fit together. And we will find that even with regard to someone whom we consider thoroughly despicable, thinking, this person never does anything that would not conform with this concept, that even with such a person we find a great deal that does not fit in, that contradicts what he or she does. And one need not take into account at all the relationship toward oneself. One can disregard it and place people before one's soul in terms of their own conduct, if it is necessary to judge them at all. But it strengthens the I if we consider that we could well give up most, perhaps 9/10 of the judgments we make, if one experienced only 1/10 of the judgments that one makes about the world, really only 1/10, it would be richly sufficient for life. It would not compromise our lives in any way, not even for ourselves, if we decided to forego the remaining 9/10 of the judgments that we so often make. It may appear that I have presented trivialities today, but considering such things is our task from time to time, for it can be shown how trivialities have great effects, and how we must get hold of life by quite other means than we normally do if we are to construct our life in a strong and healthy way. It is not always correct to say, well, if people are sick, let them go to a drugstore, and there they will find what they need. It would be better for them to order their lives so that they are struck by illness less often, or that sicknesses become less oppressive. And this will be possible if, through such trivial things as I have presented, a person strengthens the influence of the I over the astral body, of the astral body over the etheric body, and of the etheric body over the physical body. Self-education, as well as contribution to the education of others, are things that can proceed from our fundamental anthroposophical conviction.
End of Side 2. This concludes Tape 1 of Anthroposophy in Everyday Life.